Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Audio Open Lines. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, the 27th of June. We're talking about prenatal testing for Down syndrome, listening to a PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly story on that very subject. Let's go to Susan, who's patiently waiting in Mississippi. Susan, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I just wanted to touch on a couple of things that the lady said in the report, the one who'd chosen an abortion. One thing she said was that she, the abortion did have a lingering effect on her, I guess, on her conscience. So it seemed that she just ended up trading one burden for another. But she also mentioned that her husband was so supportive, and I wondered if that just meant that, well, then he had to go along with whatever she wanted to do. Was he supportive of either decision? In other words, what is the decision in these things? They only talk to women, to mothers. What about the fathers? What about the men? Don't they have anything to say about this? And wonder why they were left out.
Susan, thank you very much. It's a good question. Thanks for waiting on the line to pose it. In answer to your second one, increasingly, legally, men have very little say, very, very little say, as to if they're not, even if they're a married father, they have very little say about what happens to their children. This is what Roe v. Wade, it is only the logical extension of Roe v. Wade, that it's a woman's right to choose. And a woman's right to choose can't be usurped by anyone, government, anyone, law, no, and not the husband either. Because what Roe told us is that it's a woman's right to choose. And I agree with you. It takes two to make a child, and for some reason we have the woman's right to choose, but the man's right is non-existent. It's a good point to make. Now, I think you were right when you say she was trading one burden for another. And I wonder, in retrospect, I don't think the report actually gets this detailed into her reflections on the abortion she had to eliminate a Down syndrome child. I wonder whether she, if she had to do it over again, she would bear that burden, but with a living child. You see, the burden she now bears is difficult, the guilt of having an abortion, but made all the more difficult because she has no child. The burden she would have borne with the Down syndrome child would have been difficult, very difficult, but born there with a living child. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
50 years ago, children with Down syndrome were labeled mongoloid.
And years ago, we would institutionalize kids like this.
Right. And now we kill them. I think that all of this money spent trying to find them and eliminate them would be far better spent trying to educate and take care, provide.
In one sense, Lucy's birth was unusual. Doctors estimate that when faced with the prospect of giving birth to a child with Down syndrome, 80% of mothers choose to terminate their pregnancies.
Should we do some colors?
This clinic at Children's Hospital Boston provides early intervention for children with Down syndrome. Its director, Dr. Alan Crocker, is troubled that so many women choose not to give birth to babies with the condition.
There is a broad failure to understand the meaning of this kind of special person. I see joy both in myself and in them. And when I stand back and look at the larger scene, we are all the richer for having a diverse society.
For three decades, geneticist Elsa Rich has been counseling pregnant women. Doctors, she argues, should tell expectant mothers medical facts, not try to influence moral choices.
Now, who am I to say, of course you can cope with it. Other people do, so you can cope with it too. I think that's their judgment to make.
Rich says expectant mothers worry about the cost of raising a Down syndrome child, about how that child will affect siblings, and mostly how the child will cope.
And the older parent feels worries of who's going to take care of that child when I'm not here anymore. I think, we think of our society, we're very fast moving. How is this child going to get along in the society?
Adults with Down syndrome may surprise us, but not themselves. 24-year-old Sujit Desai in Rome, New York, is an accomplished musician who gives concerts and lectures. And 29-year-old Carrie Bergeron has a gift, working with small children. Both Carrie and Sujit have Down syndrome. This summer, they plan to get married.
To us.
Cheers. I just wanted to tell everybody else who has Down syndrome and special needs that they can have dreams and they can accomplish their dreams in any way they can.
We're listening to a PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly story on prenatal testing for Down syndrome. Hey, this is being pretty even-handed, if you ask me. I mean, we are hearing all sides, the good, the bad, and the ugly of this issue. So 80% of women who are given the choice to abort a Down syndrome child or a child that's been tested for being at high risk for Down syndrome, they choose to abort that. That's not to say that 80% of all Down syndrome children are aborted. It is to say that 80% of the women who know that there's a risk there and are given the choice choose to abort the child, which explains why we see fewer and fewer Down syndrome children in adults, which fits beautifully with the goal of some who would want to eliminate these people from society. You know, the one question that isn't being asked here is why? Okay, yes, there's the difficulty in raising a Down syndrome child, and yes, there's the difficulty in often these children are born to older parents, and who will take care of this person? And that's expense, and that's difficulty. But, you know, since when have we backed away from things that are expensive and difficult? We do all sorts of things in our lives that are expensive and difficult. I don't think it's about the expense. I don't think it's about the difficulty. I think it's, if we're honest, I think it's about the fact that, and I think this applies to each and every one of us, that in some sense, as much as we would like to deny it, piously kind of deny it, we might regard someone who's less than what we are or different than what we are as less human, less worthy of protection. You know, I was talking earlier about those early 20th century advocates of eugenics, and the way they talked and the things that they wrote just shock us. They even shock people who advocate exactly the same ideas. They've just found nicer ways of saying the same things. But this serves only as a symptom, only as a test case, because it always begins with those who are weakest and, at least in our own eyes, least among us. Is anyone advocating aborting children because they're too strong, because they are of too good a genetic stock? No. It always starts with the least and the weakest and the most defenseless. And then it always proceeds to people who are a little bit more and a little bit stronger. This is why disability rights groups are so concerned about the abortion rate for Down's children. Because they know that they're next, or that people like them are next. They know it. They've watched the progress of these things throughout history. Wesley Smith calls it a culture of death, a culture in which death becomes the answer. Whether it's Jack Kevorkian saying, oh, look, you're sick, or maybe you're not even sick, maybe you're just depressed, death is the answer. To women who say, look, my life is going to be messed up, I won't be able to finish school, I won't be able to have a career, what is the answer? Abort the child. Now, they do it with moral qualms, and they do it and suffer the guilt for years and years, but they still do it. 505-780-50, 1-800-730-2727. Let's wrap up this piece from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly.
Carrie and Sujit are lucky. They benefit from a state program which provides housing and special assistance. Many states don't offer that kind of support. But they insist their so-called handicap is in the way we look at them, not in who they are.
I don't think it's a handicap. It's just that we are special no matter what we are, because we are a person first.
Do you want to try?
Special and different. Like most people with Down syndrome, 6-year-old Benjamin Allard knows he is not like everybody else.
He gets himself ready in the morning, and he came downstairs, and I said to him, "Oh, look at you. You look so handsome today." And he said, "Mommy, I'm not handsome. I'm different." And that broke my heart.
Physically, they are different, too. When just 2 months old, Lucy had to have open-heart surgery. Carrie has had heart and respiratory problems. In 1983, the life expectancy of someone with Down syndrome was just 25. Now, it is 56.
There are some who have more challenges in school than others. They might need extra support in the classroom. And what research is showing that when that support is provided, they're excelling.
Dr. Brian Scottko, who surveyed more than 1,000 pregnant women given prenatal tests, concluded that many doctors are insensitive, ignorant about Down syndrome, and the potential of those born with the defect. Dr. Scottko's fear, and the fear of others, is not that those prenatal tests will reveal genetic abnormalities. The fear is that those tests will be used to search and destroy those with disabilities.
Society saying everybody has to be perfect. I don't believe that you can test away everything. You can test away all of the things that make life hard. I think the women aren't given a real indication of how not horrible this is.
For now, though, women will continue to agonize on bringing into the world a child like Benjamin, or, as with Ellen Wickstead, deciding not to.
I wouldn't have done it differently. And I'm no more morally at ease with that now than I was then. I would make the same decision, and I would feel equally awful about it.
A choice with consequences then and now.
Do you ever just shake your head and think you did come close to losing him? Even?
I can't even think about it. Yep. Because I can't imagine life without him.
Born with an old abnormality, which some are now starting to see differently. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Bob Faugh in Franklin, Massachusetts.
All right, there's the story. Let's hear from you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Should Christians have prenatal testing if we avail ourselves of it? Would you be worried about the temptation? This one woman in the end of the story talking about how she'd do it again, but she wouldn't feel good about it, and she'd still have the same moral problems with it, but she said she'd do it again. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. To Pauline in Columbia, Illinois. Hi, Pauline. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Pastor Wilkin. I just wanted to comment about the prenatal testing. My husband and I have 3 children, and my last baby I was 40. And believe you me, I was given about every test option available and scrunched the numbers and given the risk factors for Downs. And, I mean, I just ultimately decided that I knew whatever would happen, I knew God would get us through that. And I knew in my heart I couldn't destroy a child. And another one of the issues that kept coming up in my mind, too, with my doctor was I finally leveled with him and I said, "Look, do you perform abortions?" And he said, "No, I do not perform them." He said, "How can you? It's a baby." And I said, "I'm really thankful you told me that, because if I knew he was willing to perform an abortion, he really didn't value a life. I mean, he didn't value whether he delivered a live child or whether he terminated that child. But, you know, there's no guarantees in life. You can have a baby that's perfectly normal and healthy, and 5 years down the road, they're in a horrible accident, and they could have horrible physical impurities. You know, there's just no guarantees.
Thank you very much, Pauline. Good thoughts. Exactly. I mean, what parent doesn't spend sleepless nights or days worrying about the safety of their children, worrying about something terrible befalling their children? There are no guarantees. look, the womb is God's playground. That's He does His thing there. You know, we can procreation can be viewed as pure medicine. I don't know how to put it. Pure physiology. It can be viewed that way. It's no different than the birds and the bees. Everybody procreates. This is why this word for Christians is so good. I think Christians ought to hang on to this word procreation, even though it sounds old-fashioned and archaic. The other alternative, reproduction. Well, reproduction is, we do a lot of reproduction here at the radio station. You can reproduce all sorts of things. There's no life involved. If I take a document and put it in the copier and press 100 copies and press the button, walk away, when I come back a few minutes later, I've got 100 reproductions. It's a very sterile way to think about the gift of human life. So I think Christians ought to stay with the word procreation. Now, let's go from Pauline's call to that thought, if we could. What's happening in the womb, even when the result is what we would consider a child with a defect, is still God's activity. Now, granted, there are defects and illness and death in this world, and they are against God's will, which is to say they are the result of our sin, our fallenness, and the curse that we brought upon this creation. But God still works in this fallen world. And what we call production is, in fact, procreation. God continues to create. And He does it through men and women in the womb. And the gift of life that He gives there, He gives, well, you're right, Pauline, with no guarantees. All sorts of promises, but no guarantees. There might be something wrong, or at least as we look at it, there might be something wrong. But God is kind of in the business of working, as one of my friends once said, God is in the business of drawing straight lines with crooked sticks. Look, there's something wrong with me. And it started right there in the womb. The psalmist says, I was conceived and born in sin. And what we deserved was not to be born at all, not to be conceived at all. If God dealt with this the way that that His law demands, but He deals with His Son in our place. And He gives to His Son, Jesus Christ, what we deserved, death. And now, what St. Paul says is, now we as Christians, while we even used to regard Jesus from a human point of view, no longer do so. And then we no longer regard one another from a human point of view. A human point of view would lead us ultimately to exactly where our society seems to be headed. It would lead us to treating mankind as a herd to be culled, as breeding stock to be improved, rather than as sinners for whom Christ died. Now we regard no man from a human point of view. But if any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. God has attached many great promises there in the womb. He creates this life, and the promises are all attached that this is another human being for whom Christ died. And God would have, as Scripture says, all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. And we can no more regard that infant in the womb, embryo, whatever you want to call it, no more regard that person as less than human than we could Christ at the same stage of development. Would we? Christ has occupied the womb in our place so that He could live His life in our place and go to the cross in our place and into the grave in our place and out again after 3 days. He became our substitute all the way from the womb to the tomb and out again. So we can no longer regard human beings, whether they occupy the womb or whether they're closer to the tomb, as anything less than our neighbor. Jesus defines the neighbor from the ground up. He doesn't start with the highest and then say, okay, who below this great person who's strong and normal and healthy should we regard as our neighbor? How much less healthy, strong, smart do they need to be before I can say they're not my neighbor? Jesus doesn't do that. That's how we define our neighbor. Jesus defines the neighbor from the bottom up, from the least, from those who are unwanted and up. That's why you and I get to be included in those whom Jesus regards as his neighbors. A little later in the program, we're going to be talking with Helen Hull Hitchcock. There are pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians. There are lots of pro-life Roman Catholic politicians. But the ones that are a special attention of the meeting of American bishops are those pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians. It was, in the last presidential cycle, something that was more a subject for the Democratic candidate. Remember John Kerry, practicing Roman Catholic, flying in the face of his church's teachings on life. And then, here comes Rudolph Giuliani. Now it's a Republican candidate for president who is flying in the face of his church, same church, in his church's teachings on human life. So what is a bishop to do? Some of them are taking a harder line than others. The old cliche is that life is a gift. If we really take this seriously, then the gift that God gives in whatever form he gives it, we as Christians ought to regard as just as that, as a gift, as a good that God has given us. Now, does that mean we will be able to see how good the gift is? No. Look at it this way. If you would have known as a parent the heartache, the trouble, the worry, the sleepless nights, the expense, the difficulty that it has meant having children, be honest, and you had to do it over again, you might not have done it. You might not have done it. Kids are hard. But no, you regard these children as a gift of God. And the gift has come with difficulty and tears and expense and hardship and joy. But what makes the gift good, what makes the gift worthy of being received with joy, is not even really the gift itself, but the one who gives it, God. As long as God is the one giving life, then who are we to regard the gift he gives in the womb or anywhere else along the stages of human development as anything other than good? We'll be right back to talk about those Roman Catholic politicians.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Old Testament Psalms have been the prayer book of God's people for millennia. This is as true for Christians today as it was for the people of God in the Old Testament. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June is a great devotional resource called Reading the Psalms with Luther, a Christ-centered, cross-focused reading of the Psalms. The book is $14.99. You can find it at either of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores, 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. The book is called Reading the Psalms with Luther. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June. Those two locations, 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Now the historic prayer book of the church can be your prayer book too. Make the Psalms part of your daily Christian devotion with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, Reading the Psalms with Luther.
Fossils, what mean these stones?
Answers with Ken Ham.
a popular speaker on the book of Genesis. Well, Ken, because fossils are dead things, can they actually mean something for us today?
Well, after the miracle of the crossing of the Jordan River, Joshua instructed the Israelites to take 12 stones and build a memorial. Now, this was to be a reminder of what God did for them. We read in the Bible that Joshua told the people that when their children asked the question, "What mean these stones?" they were to be told of this wonderful miracle. These 12 stones were to stand as a memorial for the children of future generations so God's people wouldn't forget what God did. This is a reminder to me that when our children look at the fossils in the ground all over the earth and ask us the question, "What mean these stones?" we should not forget to tell them what God has done. We tell them, God judged sin with death. That's why we see death in the world today and in the fossil record. We also tell them, at the time of Noah, God judged the wickedness of man with a global flood. As a result of this massive flood, billions of fossils were formed all over the earth. So what mean these stones? Don't forget to tell your children the truth about the fossils, the flood, and about the origin of sin and death and salvation in Jesus.
What's the truth about dinosaurs? Don't they show that the Earth is really millions of years old? Well, you may be surprised at the answer when you read Ken Ham's free booklet on our website, AnswersRadio.com.
Do you realize how advertising often motivates you to buy a product out of self-interest? Today's marketing is even more sophisticated. Unfortunately, there are some who attempt to use the contemporary techniques of marketing to grow a church. We will talk about the propriety of such techniques on the next broadcast.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
Well, I'm glad Jesus didn't feel that way about you.
Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, responding to the idea that the AIDS crisis is self-inflicted and Christians need not respond in love.
Look, you reap what you sow. You're a sinner. You're damned to hell. Go rot. That's not Jesus. And the Bible doesn't tell us, Jesus says, "You made your bed, now lie in it. I'm not going to help." So it's an impossible response for a Christian. Even though we know that actions have consequences, but consequences, those consequences don't kill mercy and don't kill a proclamation of the law in order to bring the gospel.
Find LCMS World Relief at our homepage, issuesetc.org, Christ-centered, cross-focused, love for the neighbor.
I'm a practicing Catholic, and it is the biggest dilemma for me in terms of comporting my religious and cultural views with my political responsibility. Even within our own church, there's been debates about life, you know, from Summa Theologica and Aquinas and 40 days to quickening and right to, you know, Pius IX and Defeat a Doctrine and so on. So Roe v. Wade is the closest thing politically to what has been the philosophic division that's existed among the major confessional faiths in our country.
Well, that's quite a statement. That's Senator Joseph Biden speaking recently on Tim Russert's Meet the Press on his position on abortion. He says, personally opposed, but legally in favor. And he's not alone in that position, especially among pro-choice Roman Catholics. He says he's a practicing Roman Catholic. This is a subject not only of interest when it comes to people like Senator Biden, but many other Roman Catholic politicians who are pro-choice. We're going to talk about a recent story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on that subject and react to it. Helen Hull Hitchcock is our guest. You can join us as well in the last half hour of Issues Etc. today, this Wednesday, the 27th of June, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Helen Hull Hitchcock is a regular guest, director of Women for Faith and Family, based here in St. Louis. Helen, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
When you hear a Roman Catholic politician like Biden or others, and his is a common statement, really at ease with Roe v. Wade, and yet at the same time expressing personal distaste or moral outrage at something like abortion, what do you think? How do you react?
Well, the thing that is difficult, I think, is when one says one is a Catholic, that implies that one subscribes to the teachings of the Catholic Church. And you can't subscribe to the teachings of the Catholic Church and reject one of the fundamental moral teachings, and that is the value of life. Back in February, when Pope Benedict the 16th issued his first encyclical, he reaffirmed the grave responsibility, those are his words, of Catholic politicians and legislators to consistently uphold Catholic moral teachings. And he says, I'm going to quote this because this is probably good to get this in at the beginning of our little talk here. He says, these values are not negotiable. Consequently, quote, Catholic politicians and legislators, conscious of their grave responsibility before society, must feel particularly bound on the basis of a properly formed conscience to introduce and support laws inspired by values grounded in human nature. He says, also continues, that's the end of that little quote, and then after another sentence, he says, bishops are bound to reaffirm constantly these values as part of their responsibility to the flock entrusted to them. Now, that forms the Catholic background, as it were, for this moral issue. And a Catholic politician has got to, if he's going to be Catholic and if he's going to be a politician, he's going to have to come to terms with the teachings of the Christian faith on the value of human life.
How do you respond to those, and this is often how it is sometimes characterized in the press, how do you respond to those who say, well, if a bishop were to do what he's directed to do there in those words, he would be tampering with our political system and he would be violating the sacred separation between church and state?
Well, I'll put this, there's a bishop who has spoken out on this recently, and he was actually quoted toward the end of the, or referred to at the end of that Post-Dispatch story you were talking about, the Associated Press story. It's Bishop Arthur Saratelli of Paterson, New Jersey. Now, what's interesting about him, most of your listeners haven't heard of him, he's not very famous, but he has been chairman of the Bishop's Committee on Doctrine, and he will become, in November, after the November meeting, he will become the chairman of the Bishop's Committee on the Liturgy. He's a scholar, well-versed in canon law and in theology as well. And he spoke about this, and he said, and this is a quote from Bishop Saratelli, why should the church not have a right to voice her teaching on this important issue in the public square? She must speak, and speak often. Abortion may be for some just a political issue, but for the innocent child, it is a matter of life or death. Now, he's responding to a situation that I think was also alluded to in that story about 18 Catholic Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives wrote a letter after the Pope made clear that this abortion is a moral evil and a murder and could not be held by anybody who is a believing Catholic, whether they're a politician or not. And 18 members of the House of Representatives, 18 of the 88 Catholic Democrats in the House of Representatives, spoke out against the Holy Father, wrote a letter, and they strongly chastised him, and they said his words, they said, quote, offend the very nature of the American experiment.
I must wonder a couple things. First of all, did the Pope intend in any way by his Mexico statements to tamper with the American experiment, in your opinion?
Well, what is the American experiment? Freedom of speech and freedom of religion is part of, is one of the foundational things of the quote-unquote American experiment that we know about, and the right to express one's deeply held convictions about something so fundamental as the meaning and value of human life is not something that conflicts with the American experiment.
Is this symptomatic of a greater dissent, especially among American Catholics, that 18 of the members of the House of Representatives who are Roman Catholic and pro-choice felt really no compunction whatsoever in actually condemning the Pope's statement, wherein the Pope said nothing new and put no new restrictions whatsoever on anyone, but simply reiterated and repeated the Church's teaching on this?
Well, any politician, of course, has the freedom to reject what Christianity teaches. But a Catholic politician doesn't have a right to overturn the Church's teaching just because of political expediency. If they don't believe it, then they have a right to leave the Church. If that's what their conviction is, if they truly believe that what the Church teaches is wrong, what the Church teaches is evil, in fact, they see as good, then, you know, then the honest thing to do would be to withdraw. That would be the American thing to do and the honest thing to do. But it's very, very arrogant to insist that the Church does not have the right to her own teaching. That's to choose to be quote unquote pro-choice is to reject the fundamental meaning of human life, and it's not faithful to Christian teaching in any way.
So we have, it seems, a spectrum here among pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians. We have perhaps more the old school style, which would have been Mario Cuomo, who was personally opposed, but he believed that there were other mechanisms by which to eliminate abortion as a legal entity in the United States. There's Rudolph Giuliani, who's about as plain as anyone can be, personally opposed, but basically in favor of it in every legal and political sense. Which would you rather have to deal with, someone who, or is there really any difference between the two?
Well, what I think is a fundamental thing for voters to look at, Christian voters, is to look at the candidate and see to what extent that person upholds the convictions of the Christian who is voting. I mean, we have a responsibility as Christians to put our ballot where our beliefs are, and that should be consistent. And to say that you're personally opposed, but it's clear that that's usually that's being said as a politically expedient thing to do. Just today, there was a long article in the Village Voice of all places, written by a pro-life person who happens to be a convinced atheist, but he sees the fundamental moral teaching that is in common with Christians and others as well of the value and intrinsic worth of human life on abortion. And he has a long article discussing the, you can only call it hypocrisy of Rudy Giuliani, who is says he's a Catholic and yet has been very proactive in supporting abortion rights down the line.
Helen Hull Hitchcock is our guest. We're talking about a recent story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on pro-choice Roman Catholic politicians. She's director of Women for Faith and Family based here in St. Louis. You can join us with questions or comments as well, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Another quotation in this story from Saturday St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the AP story, which got actually raised in a presidential debate or information forum where Giuliani was speaking, was I think it was Bishop Tobin who likened Giuliani's stance, "I am personally opposed, but," to that of Pontius Pilate, saying Pilate was personally found no guilt in Jesus but handed him over to be crucified anyway. Is that an apt comparison?
Well, yes. I mean, when you think of moral consistency, what we were talking about just earlier, about the obligation of every Christian to be consistent in the way that they live their life, and that includes the way they vote and what issues they support in the political realm. We're supposed to be Christians in the world, too, as well as in church. So it really is, I think he called the position of Rudy Giuliani pathetic and confusing. And I think he means by pathetic, it, you know, causes pain to anyone to see someone who's, you know, who's, well, shall we say, talking out of both sides of their mouth. And it's also confusing because when he says, I really oppose abortion, but then in the parenthesis or with his fingers crossed, then he says to the abortion supporters, actually, you know, I'm really with you all along here. And that's one of the points that the Village Voice story today made about his record on this issue. I might just mention, by the way, that Women for Faith and Family started in 2004. Before that election, there was a lot of talk on the same issue, and we started a section on our Women for Faith and Family website on Catholics and political responsibility. And we're still maintaining that. We didn't realize how heavy a job this is going to be when we started it out, but it is a good resource to see what the bishops are saying and what the church says and where where the church comes in on these issues and what is really being said by some of the bishops.
So what's a bishop to do? I mean, they obviously function in their diocese as individual bishops, and then they also function, at least in some sense, corporately together as a more or less united voice. What do you expect an individual bishop to do with a politician such as Rudolph Giuliani or any of the others, Joe Biden or any of the others, who flies in the face of his church's teaching on this fundamental issue of life? And what do you expect them to do together as a college of bishops?
Well, the politician may not be open to this, but the bishop should make an effort to, you know, to make sure that the person isn't just confused about some moral issue and really knows what they're doing and knows what the implications are for this person's faith and how it participating in an evil like this or supporting something that destroys human life at its very beginning, the bishop would explain what the situation is to that politician if there's any doubt about what he believes. And then the consequences are up to the politician. I mean, the politician is free to choose what he believes and supports. And if he rejects Christian teaching about human life, then he needs to be honest about that.
Have any bishops, to your knowledge, followed up from that point in first they're trying to determine what the politician's real considered ideas are here, and then if they meet a politician, a Roman Catholic politician, who says, well, you know, I'll just say I'm personally opposed, but I think it ought to be legal and federally funded and kind of the Giuliani position.
Uh-huh.
Do you know of any bishops who followed up beyond that point where everyone's clear on what everyone's stated position is? Now what do you do next?
Well, I think that it is necessary probably for everybody, again, I don't want to beat this horse to death, but to be more honest. A bishop should be willing to, as the shepherd of souls and as the shepherd of that particular member of his flock who is participating in something that is evil, needs to explain it to him and hope he can persuade him. It's possible that he might be able to. If there's no hope of that, then I think the bishop has to make clear that the rest of his flock is not misled by this one member who's leading the sheep way out of the fold.
Should a ban at the communion table be an option for the bishop here?
Well, that's I think no bishop wants to do that because it, for one thing, he's going to get really crushed in the press if he does that. But still, you'd be surprised if you look at this list on our website how many bishops are at least taking a public stand on this. and announcing it in their diocesan press or writing columns about it that they ask to be read to their by their priests at the individual parishes and so on. So far as I know, this issue has galvanized a lot of people into really confronting what the core beliefs of the Christian faith are. And many more bishops than you would expect have put their, let's say, put their jeopardized their good press, as it were, and taken steps to inform the faithful, not just the politician who may be involved, but also the rest of the Christians in his that he's responsible for.
Someone always asks at this point, Helen, look, why something like abortion, that aspect of the life issue, and not the death penalty? Why is there such concern among the bishops and Roman Catholics about their politicians when they support abortion, but not when they support the death penalty?
Well, a good many of them are opposed to the death penalty, and as you probably know, Pope John Paul was very much opposed to the death penalty because that cuts off any possibility of conversion on the part of the prisoner. But there is a difference. I think anybody can see that, or anybody, certainly any parent can see that, and that is that an unborn child or a tiny child is utterly innocent and dependent. They had no choice in anything. Whereas you could say that the person who's, a criminal who's in prison, made bad choices, did bad things, and so the prison sentences and even the death penalty, which is seldom invoked, we hope, but even that is not something that the person had no choice in. But there's no choice for the baby when we're talking about pro-choice.
So we're talking about issues that are related to one another.
Yes,
philosophically,
they are, yes.
But they are individual. They are distinct from one another in how, I guess you could say, how much weight. I think I've heard other Roman Catholics say, look, it really is a matter of the abortion issue is one where the life that is taken,
the so-called consistent ethic of life.
Yes, and the life that is taken in such a way as to so fly in the face
mm-hmm.
of the fundamental gift of human life from God, without even, I guess the issue there is due process, to put it legally, and that's why it seems to draw so much more attention.
That's one thing. The other thing is the vulnerability. For example, the Church takes a very strong and unwavering stand against any form of euthanasia or assisted suicide or hastening death or whatever you want to call it. That is also regarded as a moral issue, and that person, the person who is involved, is not it's not the same as a completely innocent, unborn human being or tiny infant, but it is the person is vulnerable and is not paying a debt to society in any way at all. The person who's a prospect for euthanasia or some other nefarious situation.
Finally, Helen, this story, and we deal with it as often as we need to, could obscure the fact that a great majority of those who serve us in public office, elected or otherwise, as Roman Catholics, actually do believe what the Church teaches and adhere to it and hold those as their own positions, both personally and politically. Talk about that a bit.
There are many who do. You don't hear about them very much because, for various reasons. One that I might mention is actually a fairly recent convert to the Catholic Church, who was a former Protestant, the senator from Kansas named Senator Sam Brownback.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been very open in his consistent support for Christian teachings on the fundamental value of human life and on all the other moral issues that the church teaches. But I think that's kind of interesting because, and there have been others, as you know, some of them have taken their lumps at the ballot box because of that. But nevertheless, I think Christian people can see that there are honest politicians out there. They're not all out for a win at any cost.
So finally, with only 30 seconds, can a politician who is either in favor of abortion or personally opposed but publicly in favor, can such a politician honestly call themselves a Roman Catholic?
That's what the Pope, the point that the Pope was making on that famous interview on the way to Brazil. It's a point that he made when I mentioned, quoted from his first encyclical at the beginning of our conversation today. That is the fundamental teaching of the, not only the Catholic faith, but of the Christian faith. It's biblical. It's absolutely a core teaching. And every person who is a truly believing Christian has to come to grips with that. And as the Pope mentioned, it's necessary for that person to form their conscience properly. It's not good enough to say, oh, well, my conscience tells me that I don't have to do that. Hmm. That means that you've got a badly formed conscience. There are such things as good and evil. And this is one of the things that I think is difficult in our society where everything seems relative. It's what's true for you is not true for me, and so on. And the only thing that is, if you adopt that point of view, the only thing that is absolutely not true is your ability to say that there's something that is absolutely not true.
Helen Hull Hitchcock is Director of Women for Faith and Family based here in St. Louis. Helen, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
Folks, when you go to our website tonight, remember there are only 3 days left in our fiscal year. It ends on the 30th of June. We have a little less than $24,000 shortfall of our annual budget for the nationally syndicated edition of Issues, Etc. of $240,000. That's a little bit less than $24,000 short of our $240,000 budget for nationally syndicated Issues, Etc. Any size gift is deeply appreciated. Help us defend life from beginning to end. You can give on the web at our website, issuesetc.org. Our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.